You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at rudolfsteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, steinerbooks.org in America and rudolfsteinerpress.com in England, who have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 191 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Understanding Society Through Spiritual Scientific Knowledge, Social Threefolding, Christ, Lucifer, and Ahriman. 15 lectures translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 6, given in Dornach on the 12th of October, 1919. In these observations, I have suggested from all kinds of different angles that what is commonly regarded as the history of humanity is in many respects a superficial view of things. To understand contemporary circumstances, it is very important to avoid all illusions about the superficiality of this view of recent historical developments. We should not, for example, assume that what holds true as the latest phase of history in the fifth post-Atlantean era applies to the whole course of human history. We should not think this. But what I am about to say does hold true for this latest phase. Socialists suggest that the reality of all human history is to be sought only in economic processes, in the dynamics of economic life, in class warfare that arises from these economic processes. In this view, these economic realities are the foundation for the superstructure of law, ethics, cultural life altogether, thus also art, religion, science, and so forth. In terms of the whole of humanity's history, this is, of course, nonsense. But we still need to ask what has given rise to this nonsensical view. It is due to there actually being some truth in this, if we consider only the latest phase of human evolution, our recent modern era. Amongst the occurrences that inaugurated this new era, we can refer, as yesterday, to upheavals in evolution that arose through the discovery of America, the discovery of the sea route to the East Indies. But we also see this latest phase of human evolution in terms of the Reformation, that great cultural upheaval that occurred at the beginning of the new era. It is necessary today to recognize the real nature of the Reformation. If we draw on everything discussed yesterday by way of preparation, which can give us a deeper view of history, not a superficial one, we find that what was apparently a cultural transition at the beginning of modern times, in fact, arose from factors that were very largely economic. And insight into the economic foundations of the Reformation has led to the narrower view propounded by socialism, that in fact all historical developments were only the result of class warfare and economic factors. If we shed the light of truth and not illusion on what happened, and on the metamorphosis occurring at the beginning of modern history, we must discern a mighty shift in the population, one that occurred fairly rapidly at the beginning of the new era. This shift involved a change in ownership of land and territory. The leading figures who dictated and determined the structure of society prior to the Reformation lost this dominance during it. Far more than people realize, all ownership of land and estates was in the hands of the church. This theocracy very largely dominated economic conditions in general prior to the Reformation. Those who owned lands and estates held it, in a sense, on behalf of authorities in some way connected with the Church. If we study the course of history with a less idealistic and more truthful eye, we discover that almost everywhere in Europe, estates were taken out of their old ecclesiastical ownership and transferred to worldly rulers. This was very much the case in England, and later on also in Germany to a large degree. Later on in Germany, a large number of territorial rulers joined the Reformation. This was not, however, invariably due to wild enthusiasm for Luther or the others driving the Reformation, but to a hunger for church land, the longing to secularize church estates and properties. Huge amounts of church estate were transferred to worldly rulers, to regional barons. In England, a large proportion of those who owned properties and estates were divested of these and emigrated to America. A large number of those who emigrated to America, and yesterday we looked from another angle at what underlay this, were expropriated owners of land in Europe. In other words, the changes and developments usually referred to as the Reformation were greatly influenced by economic factors. A superficial view sees this as a new spirit entering human souls, resulting from the old church incorporating too strong a worldly element into its spiritual outlook, sees this as the need to find a more spiritual path to Christ again, and so on. But if we delve somewhat deeper, we see that an economic shift occurs with the transfer of ecclesiastical property to worldly people. But this is connected with a very far-reaching fact of world history, and we only understand the diverse facts of modern history by looking back on a broader scope of human evolution. Here we need only look back to the phase of human evolution, which we call the Egypto-Chaldean, which, as you know, ended in the mid-8th century BC, when the Greco-Roman era began, and in turn lasted roughly to the middle of the 15th century. If we go back to ancient Egyptian, ancient Chaldean culture, the ruling powers at that time were of a quite different kind from what they later became. Today, people give little thought to the great upheavals that occurred in the course of history. In those times, which ended roughly in the middle of the 8th century BC, the rulers were people whom one could call initiates within the older traditions of spiritual science. The Egyptian pharaohs, up to a certain point in time, were definitely initiates. They were initiated into the secrets of cosmology and regarded what they had to do on earth in a cosmological context. If you state such a thing today, you encounter difficulties of understanding, for the simple reason that modern people, with their modern consciousness, object that these initiates, the Egyptian pharaohs, and also the Chaldean rulers, did things that were highly questionable. Of course, we might say that modern uninitiated rulers also do some things that do not exactly accord with the highest moral standards. But this would be a misplaced objection here, of course. We have to point out, though, that beyond the confines of the sense world, there are not only good gods, but also gods that act counter to human interests, as these are usually regarded. This means that someone who is a real initiate will not inevitably act only out of good motives. In saying, as I do now, that the pharaohs were initiates, you only need recognize that they acted out of spiritual impulses. Spiritual impulses, sometimes very bad ones, lived in their will. and this cannot be disputed by anyone who has come to understand, through anthroposophy, that all kinds of divine spiritual powers, supersensible powers, lie behind the world of the senses. Until the middle of the 8th century BC, the real rulers were those who could incorporate into their will, and not just their awareness, what divine spiritual powers gave them. Then a time began, during which, if we strip away all the illusions that our ordinary history veils it in, the real rulers were the priests. The worldly rulers themselves, even someone like Charlemagne, were more or less dependent on the priests. Military might in ancient times, up to the middle of the 8th century, was placed in the service of the initiates. In the 4th post-Atlantean era, the Greco-Roman period, up to the middle of the 15th century, soldiers were the mercenaries of the priests. And basically, campaigns such as the Crusades were essentially military expeditions on behalf of the priestly rulers. What was done had some connection or other with this ruling class of priests. Thus, in Egypto-Chaldean times, rulers were from the initiate class. Then, from the mid-8th century BC to the middle of the 15th century, the class of priests ruled. And from this time onward, quote, Homo economicus, close quote, became dominant in history. The names themselves don't matter much. As we move forward through history, names matter less and less. But what underpinned and sustained the process of ruling and governing was the ability to engage in economic affairs. The important thing about the priests and initiates of olden times was that these dominant rulers could engage in economic circumstances, although they did this from higher perspectives. And then in more recent history, the economic type likewise involved itself, really, in all aspects of social structure. But this is connected with something else, which I pointed to already in relation to the initiate as ruler. The ruling initiate class worked through their will by incorporating into this will the spiritual impulses of higher worlds. This was no longer so in the priestly class. The priest type does not embody spiritual life in a full fundamental sense. And for this reason, in civilizations where the priest was dominant, in European civilization, the intellect became the primary quality instead. In Asia, in the Orient, spiritual life, rather than intellectual life, is the essential thing. You see, the civilization that still exists there has succumbed largely to decadence. But nevertheless, there are remnants of something that was once initiate culture, spiritual culture. When the religious impulse of the Orient was carried over to Europe, it passed into the intellectual outlook of the priests. Initiation into realities, into the world of spirit, grew to be theology, an intellectual assimilation of the realities of the spiritual world. Theology is an intellectualized assimilation of the realities of the world of spirit. But this priest class, which intellectually assimilated spiritual realities and proclaimed them in an intellectual form, gave way at the beginning of the new era to the class of economists, to Homo economicus. We can identify specific phenomena that show the emergence of this type of economic human being, and we will speak of this in a moment. But we must, of course, first ask this: what causes such changes and transformations throughout history and evolution? It is due to something that in turn requires us to go deeper than a merely superficial view of history. It becomes clear, if you read what they write, that historians see no great changes occurring in the inner life of human beings during the course of history. Materialistic thinkers hold the view that an ape-like being once wandered about on the earth, and from this the human being emerged, very slowly, of course, but modern science likes to see things developing slowly. Once the human being was here, his mind, consciousness, and inner state underwent no great change. Today we may imagine ancient Egyptians to be a little more childlike than ourselves, not yet as clever as we have become. But in general, people think that the ancient Egyptians had an inner sensibility roughly resembling our own. In fact, if we look back to the time preceding the mid-8th century BC, this sensibility and state of mind was quite different from what it became after that period. If you examine the soul configuration of modern people and are only aware of this frame of mind, you cannot form any picture of what lived in someone prior to the 8th century BC. These people still had a living connection with their preceding incarnation. For the broad swath of so-called pagan peoples, other than the Hebrew-speaking peoples, for whom things were a little different, inner soul experience was very much the outcome of their preceding incarnations, preceding lives on earth. It was quite apparent to them that an experience of worlds of spirit filled them inwardly. They had no doubt at all that their essential aspect was not passed down to them by father and mother, but had descended from worlds of spirit to unite and combine with what came from their parents. The inner sensibility of these people was very much rooted in their spiritual culture, and therefore their society could be governed by initiates, by those who to some degree had been initiated into spiritual realities, and not only in thoughts, intellectually. In speaking of spiritual realities to people in those times, you were speaking of something they were wholly familiar with. Really, all human beings saw themselves as centaurs. They saw their physical body as arising from physical heredity, and overlaid upon this was what had descended from worlds of spirit. Everyone knew this. Everyone pictured themselves as a kind of centaur. Then came the time that began with the 8th century BC, roughly the time when Rome was founded. Real spiritual connection was lost during this era. We have considered this previously from other points of view. But a certain spiritual connection remained with worlds of spirit through human intelligence. The human being no longer pictured himself as a centaur. He no longer felt that a higher spiritual entity had descended and united with what came through heredity. Instead, he had a clear awareness that his intelligence, his world of thoughts, was not dependent on his blood or physical corporeality, but that it was instead of spiritual origin. We do not properly understand the great philosopher Aristotle if we do not know that in calling the highest aspect of the human soul Dianeticon, he was very much aware that this highest part of the soul, which is intellectual in quality, has filtered down from worlds of spirit and soul. Aristotle was fully aware of this, and indeed people continued to be fully aware of it during early Christian times. This awareness that human intelligence has a divine spiritual origin was only lost during the 4th century AD. At that point, people gradually stopped believing that their faculty of thought filtered down to them at birth from soul spiritual worlds. a great change occurred within the human soul. If we go back to the first three Christian centuries, we find that people then knew both that they were descended from their parents, but also, in the same way that their eyes knew light directly without cogitating on it, that their intelligence came from the gods. This was immediate awareness for them, like the immediacy of a sense perception. Only in the course of the 4th century AD did people increasingly gain a different feeling of their head as a bony cavity, which it is, of course, as we have discussed in the past, containing the organs of intelligence, in turn connected with physical heredity, with blood relationship. Only in this era, with the transition from belief in the divine nature of intelligence to physically inherited intelligence, could intellectualization of the religious impulse, as one might call it, be accomplished by the dominant priest class. And once this intellectualization was far advanced, and the view of intelligence had become inseparable from the human body, the dominance of the priests also came to an end. The priests could only continue to rule while it was still possible to communicate old traditions of the divine nature of intelligence. Homo economicus emerged in history at the moment when belief in the divine nature of intelligence had faded, and people increasingly saw the physical human being as the essential bearer of thinking, as its organ. But we must not forget how the priests fought to maintain their dominance and still do so today. Those familiar with Catholic theological literature, for instance, know how the class of priests still battles with all possible philosophical arguments to prove that the intelligence within us is something given to us from without. Read any of this literature, and you will find no denial of something regarded as incontrovertible by people today, that all other faculties inhere in human corporeality except intelligence. Catholic theology seeks to retain intelligence as something divine and spiritual that has no intrinsic connection with human corporeality. In general, the human mind does not accept this. In general, people feel that the body is what enables us to think, the basis of intelligence. Thus, increasingly, people have come to regard themselves as really only a physical being. Homo economicus could only emerge under the influence of a kind of spirituality that assumes we are only physical beings. There are, therefore, deeper spiritual reasons why Homo economicus rose to the surface, and surface is about right, since this was something narrowly and superficially interpreted in socialist theories. The human being as economic species has been predominant since the Reformation. And so you can see what spirit holds sway in the faiths and confessions that have arisen since the Reformation. Let us have no illusions about this spirit. On the one hand, we have mundane science, with the technology penetrating ordinary everyday life and its rejection of all faith. Religious matters are not supposed to disturb the sphere of this externalized science. Faith, meanwhile, is meant to be prettily conserved in a separate compartment as far as possible from the realities of life. Science in one compartment with its own accounts, religious faith in another compartment, likewise with its own separate accounts. Ne'er the twain shall meet. The economic human being desires faith, desires even to be pious. The more pious, the better. You can see him heading for church on Sundays, prayer book demonstrably in hand. But religion must never muddy the ledger of financial accounts, except, of course, for the sacrilegious phrase, "with God," that precedes them. Footnote, translator's note, the words "with God" were once used on the first page of German bookkeeping ledgers. End of footnote. Religion must be kept at arm's length from financial matters. Otherwise, one might easily conclude that in many respects the Reformation was only a roundabout way of secularizing and confiscating church assets, a means whereby worldly rulers could seize them. A German prince or an English lord could not have boldly stated the intention of creating a new era in world history by dispossessing those who once owned all property. Modern socialists say it, of course. We are expropriating the owners of land and property. But this was not something said at the beginning of the modern era. They did it, but drew a veil across their actions by saying they were establishing a new religious confession. People are then ignorant of what underlies their piety, but they take pleasure in this illusion under which they hide the real reasons for their pious faith. And in this way, Homo economicus rose to the surface. The sense of experiencing a spiritual reality within gradually faded. That is the deeper spiritual cause of what happened. If we go still further back, to before the third post-Atlantean epoch, which ended in the mid-8th century B.C. and started in the 3rd and 4th millennium B.C., we arrive at a structure again entirely different. However paradoxical it may sound to modern ears, no one in the 4th or 5th millennium B.C. believed that his descent from mother and father was of essential importance. In those days, people were still sure that their essential being had descended from the heavens, if I can express it like that. They did not think of themselves as having an earthly origin, but a spiritual one. And the Jews spoke of the epoch when people began to feel their human nature in their physical flesh as the fall, as the beginning of, in quotes, original sin. This first took hold of them at the beginning of the third post-Atlantean era, when they began to attribute a part of themselves to physical heredity, to father and mother, and to blood relationship, thinking only that a spiritual element overlaid this physical matrix. It took hold of them again a second time, when they began to regard the element of intellect as something inherited, as something connected with corporeality. And other falls will come in future. In our own time, our task is to return to spirituality in a different way. To do so, we must be able first to regain a spiritual intellectualism. It must be possible for us to give our earthly life a meaning within which something spiritual becomes discernible. If, for instance, we consider things contained in my book titled Occult Science, it cannot be said that the intellectuality used to comprehend these is bodily in origin. Using bodily reason, we cannot arrive at what is said there about the cosmos and the human being. This, therefore, involves re-educating ourselves to comprehend an intellectualism that is spiritual. Modern humanity will have to first reconcile itself to seeing intellectualism as something divine and spiritual again. And after this, it will be possible to embark again on a return to spirituality as such. This is a task that humanity must take up consciously, to return to spirituality, firstly, by spiritualizing intelligence. Human beings must learn again to think in a way that is imbued with spirituality. The best way to begin to do this is to comprehend ethical matters, and to lead ethical concerns back to moral imagination, to the kinds of moral intuitions I described in my title, Philosophy of Freedom. If, as I expressed it there, one sees in the moral sphere something that draws its impulses directly from the world of spirit, this is the beginning of spiritualizing the intellect. I first expressed this quietly and cautiously in my title, Philosophy of Freedom, since at that time, in the 19th century, one could not expect people to countenance much in the way of spirituality. Homo economicus, who emerged with the Reformation, really saw his task as being to make all intellectualism into a physical, bodily matter. This Homo economicus, in the age of the Reformation, quickly sundered himself from a spiritual understanding of earthly human life. I can cite a few examples to show this. In the first part of the 16th century, Thomas Cromwell, not to be confused with Oliver Cromwell, was living in England and was highly influential in the introduction of Reformation principles into that country. James I wished to save the old priestly dominance, and we best understand him if we see him in this light, as the preserver of priestly influence and rule. But others thwarted these plans, among them Thomas Cromwell, an early representative of Homo economicus. We can only understand Thomas Cromwell if we know that he is one of those who tarried only briefly in the world between death and rebirth, before being reincarnated on earth. Amongst ruling, leading individuals in more recent times, there are an extraordinary number who spent only a short time in the world of spirit before their present life. As I have often mentioned, one of the most significant phenomena in recent history is the selection of the least fit as rulers. I've been saying this on various occasions for many years. Our rulers and leaders are not the best of the bunch. The times have led to a situation in which the best today remain in the lower echelons, whereas those promoted to high positions are often not the best by any means. And this selection of the unfittest is due to the fact that they had only a very short intervening period between their last life on earth and their present one. We find this to be true of a great many of the leading personalities of modern times, a speedy return to earth after only a short period in the world of spirit. This means they are little imbued with spirit. They have assimilated few spiritual impulses in their life between death and rebirth. In consequence, they are impregnated instead, all the more, with everything that only the earth can endow them with. The Homo economicus types are those who had lived only a short time in the world of spirit and were entirely pervaded by what only the earth as such can give. This is not to say that there have not also been important figures in modern times who spent longer periods between death and rebirth, but they were kept under. This was something dictated by the destiny of historical developments, by the general karma of humanity. And these facts have influenced humanity's culture today. It really is woeful to see the very common phenomenon in modern times of people who are far, far inwardly superior, looking up to certain authority figures who are far, far worse in nature. This is a general phenomenon today. Revered authorities are truly not the elect, not superior types of human being. A time has arrived when the adulation and acclaim of modern civilization should fall quiet, so that we can instead perceive and engage with actual unvarnished realities. people must try to accustom themselves to regard life in terms of the inner configurations of souls rather than superficial glances. And one of the facts that plays in here is the need to distinguish between people who spent a longer period in the world of spirit between death and rebirth, and those who tarried there for a shorter period. We need to perceive human beings from a spiritual perspective. Only when we do so will it become possible to bring conscious harmony into our social structure. Deeper insight into what is needed in society today can only be gained if we seek this insight on the basis of spiritual perceptions and knowledge. During these 3 days, I felt it my duty to show you how we must consider modern civilization in regard to the possible further evolution of humankind. You see, our earth, with everything on it, has entered upon its period of decline and decadence. I have often mentioned that insightful geologists are already pointing to this. In the context of a very rigorous, precise study of geology, purely external physical evidence can show that the earth is already crumbling away, that earth's ascending path of evolution has come to an end, and that we are really wandering about on earth's fragmenting lump of rock and soil. But it is not only earth's mineral realm that is crumbling, but organic nature too. Organic creatures are declining. The bodies of plants, animals, and human beings are no longer in a flourishing phase of evolution, but are now in decline. We no longer have the organization we had until the 4th century AD, or in the ancient Greek period. Our organization is degenerating, and the earth has entered into decadence along with us. The physical earth is declining and degenerating. I first pointed to this phenomenon many years ago in a lecture in Bonn, but mostly people do not pay sufficient attention to such things. We inhabit brittle and perishable bodies, but at the same time we must consider what goes hand in hand with this. It is precisely because our bodies are brittle that we can develop spirituality all the more if we dedicate ourselves to this. If I can draw this schematically, the bodies of ancient times, and there's a left-hand drawing, were fully pervaded by their spirituality. The body sucked up spirituality everywhere. Nowadays, our body is largely brittle, in decadence, and spirituality, right-hand drawing, sprinkles out of it everywhere, becomes free of the body. If we consider this carefully, it is apparent that we can grasp the spirituality inwardly in our soul precisely because of the brittleness of our bodies. Because of this brittleness, however, we must not rely on the physical, but instead turn to the spiritual element. Everything physical is growing brittle, is already in decline on the earth, and we should not place our hope any longer in this physical level of things. Instead, we can only expect something of what, to put it trivially, is sprinkling out, precisely because the physical realm is in decline, the spirit and soul. From this you can see one thing. Through our bodies we are connected with earth's physical conditions, which come to expression in society in economic conditions. Since all now is growing brittle, all is in decline, economic conditions are likewise growing decadent. It is idiotic to think that economic circumstances can be regenerated without more ado by economic circumstances. To dream today of some economic paradise on earth brought about by purely economic factors is like trying to galvanize a corpse into life again. If therefore you take all that exists today as purely economic theory, and let people tell you how economic life should be established on economic principles, in accordance with the laws intrinsic to it, how production relationships should be configured, how we should pass from private ownership to common ownership, and so on. You will find that it is all based on the false belief that economic life can be regenerated through economic life itself. In fact, everything physical in nature is in intrinsic decline, also in economic life. If something is in intrinsic decline, it can only ever be healed for short periods. In other words, we need instead a remedy for this economic life that is continually inwardly collapsing. If economic life were left to itself, and if people made of it what Lenin and Trotsky seek to make of it, it would just go on waning, declining, and collapsing. For this reason, we need instead to heal economic life with its opposite pole, that is, the autonomous life of spirit, which is its reverse. If you have a patient or someone who might fall ill at any moment, you must keep calling on the doctor. If you have an economic life that is continually on the point of collapse because of the very nature of Earth's evolution, you need to counteract this continually with the healing quality of an inner life of spirit. That is the inner connection. Acquiring an independent life of spirit is connected with a healthy cosmogony, or connection with the cosmos. And without an independent life of spirit, as a continual healing wisdom alongside an economic life, with its continual tendency toward decline, humanity will not progress. It is idiocy to try to regenerate economic life only through economic factors. We must instead draw on the healing potency of an autonomous spiritual life and set it alongside this economic life with the bridge of the neutral life of rights spanning these two. Unless we can recognize that the Earth's physical life is already degenerating, we will never properly understand what our modern era requires. It is a failure to recognize this that leads to so many people today believing that our economic life itself can conjure forth the means to regenerate economic life. This can't be done. Only an independent life of spirit, set alongside economic life, will keep economic life in motion. And this mysterious connection in life can be properly understood only by those who can perceive it from the point of view of a truly modern cosmogony. Consider what a serious position we are in if people run headlong toward ruin because they still think that economic life can be regenerated by its own powers, because they cannot recognize what sprinkles from the brittleness of physical existence, becoming autonomous and becoming available then as continual powers of healing. People ask what means can be employed to counteract revolutions. Well, the revolution will come once enough crises have accumulated their impulses of demise and destruction. You can only counteract revolutions by continually employing the strength that works against them. If you do not balance economic life with a continual healing life of spirit, economic life will gather and compress itself into revolutions. It is essential to realize the full gravity and significance of these things, and not to think one can simply play around with spiritual science. One can't. A Sunday sermon cannot be bodged together from true spiritual science. The kinds of habit that people acquired from their old religious confessions, seeking only to develop an inner voluptuous enjoyment through all sorts of doctrines about reincarnation and karma, is not what these teachings allow, if one takes them seriously. These teachings seek to engage with life, to become deeds by virtue of their very nature. Thus, it is not some pleasant, subjective mood to shape what lives in spiritual science also into all sorts of social ideas, but instead, really, a self-evident necessity, intrinsic to all this. Of course, anyone who speaks of evolution in the modern scientific sense, and in fact has no inkling of the fact that an ascent and flourishing first occurs, which later gives way to a process of decline, will likewise be unable to understand that we have already entered the phase of decline in earthly evolution. He will seek to elaborate forces of regeneration from degenerating processes, and this can no longer be done. What I wanted to impress on you above all in these three lectures was the profound gravity of spiritual science. It is not something to be played around with. Yes, people may dilute it into all sorts of mystical sectarianism, but playing around with it like this is a very bad idea. You cannot play around with spiritual science. There are many opponents of what we stand up for in this anthroposophically oriented science of the spirit. Almost all those who dabble their toes in mystical matters will be opposed to us. If they want to dabble merely, they will not find spiritual science to their liking, since they have no desire to feel the full seriousness of life. That is why there are so many opponents of spiritual science, especially those who like dabbling their mystical toes in all kinds of puddles. A new anti-spiritual science impetus has come about recently, driven by people who object to what they say is its scientific character, whereas, in their view, true experience of spiritual worlds must emerge from direct, immediate experience of the spirit, unsullied by anything scientific. Likewise, we have recently been opposed in an area, Munich, where we have in fact accomplished much work, but from which something murkily mystical is now increasingly emerging. A mystical book has been published in Munich, albeit by a different publisher, which basically seeks to embody such an impulse, and is entitled, quote, "Of the Living God," close quote. To apprehend these things at a time in which society is in such a parlous state shows us how much spiritual frivolity and cynicism exist today. We must give serious attention to the way spiritual life is being sucked forth from the decline and degeneration of our times. We must be able to set ourselves keenly and without prejudice against the decline of the earth, since what dies physically gives birth to living spirituality. But at the same time as anthroposophically oriented spiritual scientists, who really feel and sense the nature of spiritual things, we must develop a fine sense for all superficial dabbling in spiritual matters, and nothing should be less worthy of our sympathy than any kind of sectarianism, any kind of mystical dabbling. For this does not penetrate worlds of spirit. On the contrary, it bars the way to the spiritual world. But ways into the spiritual world are exactly what we need if we are also to make social progress. That is why the time has come now to consider the most important question of life with full consciousness. What can we actually do to energetically take up impulses that truly accord with our times? Look, this building stands here. It stands and waits for the world to take it seriously, for people really to see that it was consciously constructed, placed into a time of decline, in such a way as to capture and absorb the spirit from our era. No belief should hold sway here that it is possible to preserve the old, all that is ripe for decline and decadence. Rather, the belief should reign here that a spiritual element, which must in no way resemble the past, can be drawn forth from ongoing degeneration. This cannot be accomplished through small cultural metamorphoses. Only great cultural impulses can bring about necessary human progress toward the future. Let us study how to become strong enough to really absorb the new impulses. We must have the courage to tell people clearly what it means that the earth is in decline, and that the civilization surviving until now is accompanying this decline. But from it, we should save a new spirituality, which can be taken over into other worlds once the earth has fully succumbed to its downfall. With this building must be connected the endeavor to work in full consciousness toward a renewal of art, science, and freedom. Embodied in the forms of this building is an attempt, if you like, to scorn everything from the past. Thus we should really have the courage to take hold of the sustaining fact that this building stands here. We will not succeed by merely tinkering with things instead of working consciously and publicly to present to humanity the need for a new culture of the spirit. This alone will be the true point of departure for a new social culture. Social impulses will no longer be drawn from economic factors, but can only be implanted from the spiritual realm into the economic domain. And we have to realize that the time of Homo economicus is past, that another type of human being must come, the cosmic human being, who knows that besides physical, earthly heredity, there lives in him also the forces of the sun, of the moon, the starry heavens, of the supersensible world. We should impress this on people in forms in which they can understand it. And only then can we make a fitting contribution to humanity's real progress. Simply passing on mystical teachings will get us nowhere at all. Our mysticism must become a real active life of spirit. That's what I wanted to draw to your attention. Really, without being immodest, we should regard this Dornach building as the starting point for a great world movement, a truly international one, encompassing all areas of spiritual and cultural life. This building here should become the point of departure for stripping away any inclinations we might still have for declining, waning culture, instead encompassing an impulse truly focused on a renewal of humanity's consciousness. If we could realize in the world a new point of departure for capturing spirit from the decline of the physical earth, and if we could establish this Dornach building as a monument to this new impulse, trying to direct people's attention to what is intended here, then we would fulfill the true aims of anthroposophically oriented spiritual science. But we must bestir ourselves to create something that really speaks to humanity in a way that it can hear, that says, look, what we are doing here really does seek to cultivate the further developments of scientific, artistic, and religious consciousness. If we are able to speak of this positive impulse, we will accomplish far more than if we simply attempt to accommodate ourselves to all kinds of things that others want. We should keep in mind that something new must enter our will and intent. If we can do this, we will fulfill a worthy task. But in this respect, we should sometimes speak with our souls, in this way, really seeking to take up the task of anthroposophy. The end of Lecture 6.